Blodgett. Questions for Mr. Blodgett? Thank you again. We'll come back to Juno here. The next person, Dave Hutchins, wish to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. Our association is composed of 15 electric co-ops around the state as the active members, and we have a half dozen other electric utilities who are associate members. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 22. The first section of the bill I'd like to talk about is what is now Section 3 of the bill. It is the original legislation, which has now been amended and put in here as Section 3, deregulating the small utilities. This is not a major burning issue with us, but we do support this Section 3. We feel that it's good public policy for these small utilities, regardless of how they're organized, to be deregulated, to cut down on their costs of operation, and also to cut down on the time and expense that the Public Utilities Commission has in dealing with these small utilities. We feel that the public is adequately safeguarded here because there is provision in the statute that in this bill that the consumers can petition for regulation if they get to the point where they feel the utility is treating them unfairly. And with that petition provision in there, we feel that the public is adequately safeguarded. The rest of the bill first deals with undoing something that happened last year in House Bill 314. I was intimately involved in that, and that was one of those things that didn't come out the way we expected at all. And so I think it'd be useful for the committee if I briefly recounted what happened with Senate Bill 314 last year, or House Bill 314. It was the sunset review process for the APUC, and there were extensive hearings in the House Labor and Commerce Committee. When the bill went to House Finance, it was assigned to a subcommittee where Representative Frank was chairing the subcommittee, and our association was trying to get a provision in the bill, which I'll call your attention to. It's the sentence on lines 14 through 16. After a wholesale power agreement is in effect, the commission may not invalidate any purchase or sale obligation under the agreement. That's what we were trying to accomplish. And the reason for that was that there had been problems resulting from the fact that long after the power sales agreements were in effect between Chugach as the supplier and Matanuska Electric and Homer Electric as the purchasers, the commission assumed jurisdiction over that wholesale contract and invalidated part of the contract and purported to leave the rest of it standing. And this created serious problems among those three utilities in the rail belt. And they spent a lot of time now trying to work their way out of the problems created by that action. They've just about accomplished that, but it's taken a long time and a lot of heartache along the way. And so what we were trying to do here is to say that that in the future, we're hoping the legislature would tell the commission that in the future you should not have any more to do with a wholesale power contract between the utilities once it's in place. And the commission had opposed this in Representative Frank's subcommittee. I was asked to work with Commissioner Weatherly, chairman of the commission, to see if we could come up with a compromise. And Mr. Weatherly proposed essentially the language that you have here with one exception. And as a compromise, he concentrated on this this part down here about a reopener if the commission determines that with the passage of time that the rates are no longer just and reasonable, that there be a reopener. And we reluctantly agreed to that. And the first part was a clarification that they had jurisdiction in the first instance on these wholesale power agreements. the language that he provided us did not have this between public utilities in it. My attorney and I, in dealing with the language that Mr. Weatherly had provided, concluded that as it was written, it would affect contracts between the APA and the utilities, which up to that point were excluded from jurisdiction of the APUC. We wanted to maintain that status, and so my attorney proposed that we put this between public utilities in here to make it clear that it was the Chugach kind of contract that we were dealing with. We had no expectation whatsoever that this would later be interpreted by the Attorney General's office to read the EPA as a public utility, because they're not certificated by the PUC, and in our understanding, they're not a utility. But the later Attorney General's opinion set the compromise on its head and brought the APA under the jurisdiction of the EPUC. We think that it's extremely important that the previous law be restored, and we ask for the passage of the bill. A couple of points that have come up in previous testimony today. One is about the alternative study. Mr. Teal suggested there had not been an alternative study. There certainly has been extensive alternative studies. The process on that is that the alternative studies were done in the first instance by contractors for the APA, professional firms. And then the review process over that was done by the Office of Management and Budget and the legislature. That's the process you go through, that you went through, in authorizing construction of the Bradley Lake project. The legislature itself reviewed those alternative studies. The final point that I would like to deal with is on the Bradley Lake project itself. Mr. Teal has suggested that the Bradley Lake project should be derailed because gas is presently less expensive. It's less expensive to generate electricity from gas right now than it is from Bradley Lake. That is certainly true. That's also a short-term phenomenon. I would cite as evidence of the usual trend in these things, the Eklutna project near Anchorage. When it was built approximately 20 years ago, the price of power from Eklutna was more expensive than natural gas at that time. It came online at a wholesale power rate of 1.1 cents per kilowatt hour. With the passage of nearly 20 years, it's now up to 1.4 cents. During that same span of time, the cost of natural gas in the area has increased 14-fold. I think it's extremely important that we diversify our sources of power. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchins. Any questions, committee? Thank you very much. Now let's go back to Anchorage. There's one more individual, I believe, to testify, Mr. Ted Meninsky.
The who are concerned. One section that that would deal with the power authority wholesale power transactions. Number two, the commission didn't request this jurisdiction. As Mr. Hutchins pointed out, it was something that the commission doesn't believe was anticipated at the time that Section 431B of the bill passed last year during the sunset review, and we were all dealing with it as a matter of first impression. However, it was a legislative determination to implement the bill, and we must now assume responsibility for implementing that provision of law. But to suggest that we are here to protect jurisdiction, I think is simply not correct. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned earlier, the commission has specifically directed that we not take an advocacy position, but simply give an impact analysis of what happens if Section 22 passes versus what happens if it does not pass. I would like to respond to two other quick points and then make myself available for questions. Senator Ewing asked a question of Mr. Teal. This is Mr. Teal was unable to respond to, but I would like to respond to. And that is some reference to even if Senate Bill 22 passes, that maybe the APC
Mr. Meniske. Senator Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What were the circumstances that were surrounding the four dam pool construction that's occurred over the last 5 or 6 years, and how does that differ from where we are right now? As I understand, there was no oversight in regard to those situations.
Mr. Chairman, what we're doing, I think you're absolutely correct. The commission, as was pointed out by the witness, did not review the contracts, had no authority to the very first and then were two Attorney General's opinions on this question. The first Attorney General's opinion clarified that question and determined that based on an earlier legislative exemption of the power authority, that we did not have the jurisdiction to review the four-dam pool contract, and we did not. The second part of the question, which may be implicit in what you're asking, is, but what about this whole 511A question? I mean, have we dealt that out? What has happened? And we simply have not yet. We simply have not been faced with looking at four dam pool costs within the context of a rate case brought by a regulated utility. The issue has not been dealt with.
Mr. Chairman, a second question. Mr. Hutchins testified just briefly before the committee in regard to having another source of energy, that being electricity, the hydro project, as a basis for competition. Presently, we don't have that kind of a situation where we have sort of a different types of power that we can use. What's your opinion on that in regard to bringing another source of energy into the situation?
I wish I could provide you a competent expert opinion on that, but I certainly would be overstepping my own area of competence if I was trying to do that. I think that is a very, very important question, very important from the standpoint of overall regional power planning. Certainly, it would have great implications in terms of the state's willingness and for desirability of committing very large amounts of money to projects to create a competitive environment, which may or may not be created ultimately in the future. I simply not in a position to try to answer that question. The commission stands very much in favor of the proposition that we need to be doing whatever we can do in the nature of conservation, in the nature of finding least cost energy alternatives to keep rates at the lowest reasonable level and still maintain healthy, viable utilities.
Thank you, Mr. Meniske. Any further questions? Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meniske, what is the position there of the Commission on Section 2?
Senator, could you perhaps make your question a bit more specific?
Yes, sir. Are you in favor or are you opposed to Section 2?
I'm doing a Section 20, sir. Senator, Section 2, it is obviously the heart of the provisions of the bill that deal with the commission's jurisdiction over the power authority. Again, the only way that I can answer that is to reiterate the commission's directive to me, which is that we want to make sure that the legislature is as fully informed as possible without necessarily saying we believe that we should have continued jurisdiction or that we believe that jurisdiction should be eliminated. The component of that policy decision, I believe, go beyond the regulatory kinds of issues that this commission would normally have to consider. And in fact, other witnesses today have raised many of those issues, which I think the legislature is going to have to somehow weigh and balance one against another. The only thing that I'm really concerned about right now is to express to you as clearly as I can our concern that if we understand what this bill is supposed to accomplish, that because of the complexity of the federal legislation, passing it may simply not produce the result that you desire. But in terms of whether or not that result should be produced, is a question that I have to leave to the good judgment of the legislature.
Thank you. I guess I'm a little bit concerned there because this is kind of the heart of a lot of our deliberations that we had over the last couple of years, and I think if we go back to
to AS 4205-141, there is a phrase in there that's called liberally construed, and I think that has a tendency to pull the commission into a lot of areas in which the legislature had not intended them to become involved with. And I think that as a result of the Attorney General's opinion in this matter, I guess, which was basically requested by the commission as to what the role is between the commission and the authority, and then when we get to the section there that states liberally construed, this pulls you back into this loop again, which I don't think, if I remember our deliberations correctly, and a lot of water has gone under the bridge as lot of other logs and everything else, but I'm trying to remember exactly what happened, but I don't think that we wanted to put the commission and the authority in this posture. You want to comment on liberally construed?
Senator, I'll comment this way. Of course, I was also involved in the process that you referred to, and I realized that there were efforts to change that provision of 4205 or eliminate it, and that, of course, did not occur. Our position in what would happen if Senator 22 did not pass would simply be that we would assume the same level of contract review responsibility for those contracts that would be committed to us by regulated utilities by also the power from the power authority, as we would in evaluating the reasonableness and the prudency of any wholesale power contract that we would take a look at. I don't believe that liberty construed as applied to this particular provision will produce any greater oversight or any less oversight and responsibility that would already exist and has been demonstrated in terms of other wholesale power contracts. I'm not sure that answers your question. I think, again, if the legislature reached the determination that it wanted some degree of regulatory review of these contracts, it was concerned about the depth of that review, or it was concerned that somehow over time that review authority would be expanded as a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that the language could be written that would specifically direct the intent of the legislature in terms of how we look at these contracts. The limited supervision, as you cite, is in the statute. I see the applying here as it would apply to any other provision that we would have to interpret. But if the legislature wants to limit our involvement, I think the legislature certainly could do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple more comments. And do I gather then from your comments that you would have no objection if we removed liberally construed?
That is not my testimony. That provision of the statute is not before us at this moment. Certainly, any suggestion that it be removed or changed in any way has not been reviewed by me personally or by the commission. And I certainly would not provide testimony in that regard. My testimony is that it is in the statute and that it would be applied to this provision of the bill or to the contract review process if, in fact, Senate Bill 22 does not pass. What I am saying is that if the legislature wanted to go back and revisit Section 431B, which created this question in the first place a year ago, and wanted to add language to 431B that would somehow give the commission specific direction on how to review the wholesale power contracts that might be submitted by a regulated utility buying power from the power authority, that action would be available. There, too, should the legislature do that, I'm certain that the commission would want to take a look at the language that would be proposed and provide comment at that time. But so that my position is clear, I am not advocating any change to Section 141, and I'm simply not prepared to speak to it at this time.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We've talked about that extensively, I know, for the last couple of years, and it's certainly a new topic for this year, but maybe we can bring it up again. One other comment here, and then I think I'm going to kind of wrap this up. Let's see, I think I almost, oh, okay, almost lost my train of thought here. There was a question that came up there regarding the sale of bonds and then the effect that it could have on our bond ratings and so on, and a lot of it depended upon the commission's ability to react to the cases that it has or had before it.
What is the average turnaround time there in, let's say, an average case that comes before the commission, and how many cases do you have now pending before the commission that's been on the docket over 2 years, and then is that one case that we've had since statehood still on the docket?
Senator, I can respond in general terms to most of your questions. In specific terms to your last question, the docket that you referred to was the Chubut MLP boundary dispute has been resolved. That was a 1971 docket that has been completed. I have recently submitted to the legislature the ACBA report, and most of the specific answers to your questions are in the section called Agency Performance Impact Report. I don't have that report in my fingertips. I can't tell you that significant progress, in my opinion, has been made in terms of getting a handle on those dockets and getting those cases closed, that the turnaround time has been improved substantially, although again, I don't have the precise numbers in front of me. We are certainly in what we refer to as a fast track mode in terms of meeting certification procedures. And this is something that doesn't have a specific statutory time frame, but we believe it is one, so we have implemented our own procedure to deal with that. I would be happy to provide some follow-up information once I have my hands back on the data.
Okay, that certainly is a new twist, Renato. I read that to say that you would like a statutory timeline on our commission reviewing and making a decision on the cases that comes before it.
Again, while I was part of that senator, one of the criticisms that was surfaced during the sunset proceedings last year was that because certain things had statutory time frames, perhaps other things were not being moved as quickly as people would like. We took that criticism to heart. We have implemented procedures to move certification proceedings quickly, and they are in fact moving. We certainly don't propose a statutory time frame, and if we were to be proposed, we would comment upon it once we were looking at it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Meninsky. Any further questions?
Yes.
Senator Hensley.
yeah, this is Senator Hensley. Do you have anything more other than your paragraph on the Federal Public Utilities Regulatory Act policies? I seem to get the feeling that you don't really care whether or not this bill passes because you feel that you've got authority under the federal statutes. But you're not real specific. You just talk about the fact that our objectives may not be achieved if this bill is passed. Do you have anything firm on the question of whether or not you do in fact have authority because of federal law over these power sales agreements?
Senator, I'm really glad you asked that question. I would certainly not characterize the commission's decision as not caring whether or not this bill is passed. Obviously, if this bill is not passed, there would be a very clear statement under current OASTA statutes about this commission's responsibility for that part of its potential workload. So we care in terms of having a clear understanding of what our legislative mandate is. We're not taking an advocacy position. We're not telling you that we think you should pass this bill or should not, or that it is good public policy or it is not. In terms of
further questions? Senator Ewing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, Ted, to sum this up, I think the real question here in Section 2 of the bill is essentially what kind of oversight would occur, as Senator Hensley was asking, from the federal standpoint, and as we've heard now for a good 45 minutes of testimony here, exactly what would the federal jurisdiction be on a case like this with a power sales agreement? Is it your opinion, from all the knowledge that you have, that there will be federal oversight or not?
It is my opinion, based on the information that I have, that the federal question could legitimately be raised before this state commission, that under the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act, certain delegations have been made by Congress to state public service commissions to enforce the provisions and the intent of that federal law, and that that question could be raised before this commission, and that the relief that might be sought in raising that issue would look very similar to the relief that was sought under the state provision that SB22 would affect. That is, that the independent auditor could come before the APUC and request the APUC to enjoin or somehow or other limit the action of a regulated utility in going forward and entering into wholesale power contracts that might have a negative effect in the eyes of the independent power producer, a negative effect on the computation of what is referred to as the avoided cost, the cost that would be paid to the independent power producer by a utility to buy that power. So if there's anything that looks like it might somehow subvert the intent of the federal law, I believe that an independent power producer could come to the APUC first, if it chose to, and ask the APUC to take some action under its congressional delegation to stop that from happening. I also believe that the independent power producers have some alternatives, either in addition to or in conjunction with the action that they may take before the APUC, which could be to either file an independent proceeding in the U.S. District Court to enforce the federal statute, or perhaps to take the matter before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. There's certain provisions within FERPA that would allow the independent power producer to protect its interests by taking those alternative avenues. But certainly, we have avenues available immediately to a litigant in that position would be to raise the issue before the APUC, whether or not Section 431 be changed.
Mr. Chairman, so in summary, what you're saying is that it doesn't really make any difference if we pass the bill or we don't pass the bill, because from what you've just stated, the federal jurisdiction would possibly go into effect, and there could be even more federal oversight in regard to this. Is that correct?
I think that there are some implications to SB22 that go beyond a consideration of the FERPA type question. The very first witness that you heard testify to, you suggested that there may be some other concerns, and also other witnesses who suggest the concerns go in the other direction about the degree to which the Commission should be considering these contracts as a matter of general regulatory principle. And I think that's one issue. To the extent that we're only focusing on whether or not the very specific instance that brought this question up, which was a complaint before the Commission by an independent power producer against a regulated utility, to the extent that we answer that question with federal law or state law, my suggestion to you is the outcome may be the same. But I don't think those questions are one and the same. I think there are some very general issues of public policy that you want to consider in terms of any grant of jurisdiction to the APUC. And you really want testimony about that today. And then there's this isolated case of what we do with a FERPA generator, and there we get into the complexities of whether or not passing SB22 would have any effect given the federal legislation that we would also have to look at.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wininski. I think we'll continue on. We're going to wrap this up. I think there's one other individual from out of town. I'd like to hear testimony from them. We're going to hold this bill over, and if there are any other members here in Juneau that wish to testify at that time, they'll be able to. We have one other member for our participant from out of town who would like to testify. That's Mr. Kelly. If you could please come forward and state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Kelly. I'm general manager of Golden Valley Electric Association in Fairbanks. We are a potential purchaser of Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Energy. I would like to speak in support of the passage of Senate Bill 22 as amended. I think it's important to point out, and I'll make my testimony very brief, but to point out that what we are correcting is something that we refer to as an accident. The legislature did not originally intend for APUC to have jurisdiction in this area. They have not, in fact, exercised jurisdiction in the area that we're concerned about, and SB 22 would prevent that that accidental occurrence from happening before it, in fact, happens relative to Bradley Lake. I appreciate, I think, the APUC's intention to inform rather than advocate on this issue. Relative to the PURPA, there's been quite a bit of talk about that, and Golden Valley was the first utility in the state, I think, to go into the barrel on that. And we were dealing with a California-Idaho concern that if we would have signed the contract that was originally placed before us, we would have penalized our members to the extent of some $10 million a year. We refused to sign that contract, and we are still, after nearly 2 years, trying to resolve the issue. They filed a formal complaint, the out-of-state concern, with the APUC, and we're still working on that. We spent in excess of $100,000 in consultants, legal fees, and other fees, just trying to keep these characters from imposing excess costs on our members. And the APUC, I feel, is doing their best to protect us. Undergoing a review of the PURPA at the federal level, and I think that some of the teeth of that dog may get pulled in the next few years. So I think we would rather take the risk, and Mr. Meninsky is purely speculating as to what the Fed will do, and I don't disagree with what he has speculated, but it doesn't scare me, and we'd rather take take the risk that the Fed will reach in. I think that the key issue as far as APUC oversight would be certainly technically relative to the bonding. APA has already talked about that. I'd just like to mention one other aspect, and that's time. I think it would take a considerable amount of time for the utilities to individually bring their cases before APUC and try to go over the whole Bradley Lake issue again when we have spent hundreds and hundreds of hours of negotiations with another state agency, the APA, which is, I think, also charged with watching out for the consumer. I also feel confident that as a cooperative serving 26,000 meters in the Fairbanks area, that my seven elected board members can do a pretty good job of protecting our consumers, perhaps better than anyone else. So I would like to wrap up by saying that we are in support of SSSB 22. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Any questions? Thank you very much. This bill will be held over and be an opportunity for further testimony at a later meeting. Okay, the next bill we have before us is a Senate Concurrent Resolution, number 18. This would extend. Go ahead, we can go ahead and sign off on the teleconference now. Senate Concurrent Resolution, number 18, would extend the life of the Joint Special Committee on Local Options. This was a committee which was enacted at the beginning of the 14th legislative session to review the local alcohol option laws. There were some substantive changes made in the law as a result of the committee's work. There was still ongoing work to be done by the committee. The Legislative Affairs Agency has submitted a fiscal note with it. I would propose that this be zeroed out. The committee can actually operate with existing funds and does not need a further appropriation.
I move the resolution.
Pardon?
I move the resolution.
Is there objection? Hearing none, sir. Next bill we have before us. Is Senate Bill 50. This is an act relating to the dissolution of municipalities. There is some information before you in packets. 2 points on this one. The Judiciary Committee offered an amendment which they did not incorporate as a Judiciary Committee substitute. However, they did consider it and adopted it in Judiciary, but wished us to adopt it as a Finance Committee substitute. You have that before you, and also there is a letter of intent from the Judiciary Committee, I believe. Which we propose to change. Basically, if I could outline this legislation, what it attempts to do is rectify an oversight in the current statutes which make it difficult, if not impossible, for municipalities, particularly second-class small municipalities, which wish to dissolve their municipal status and go back to the unincorporated community status. In the case of a community in my district, they went through over 2 years of work in order to, as prescribed by the Local Boundary Commission, in order to dissolve. At the conclusion of all that, it was learned that there was problems, structural problems in the statutes, which actually prohibited them from taking the final step of disillusionment. We'll attempt to rectify that in this legislation. Are there any questions from committee members?
Mr. Chairman, is your intent to put on the letter of intent that came from judiciary on the bill?
Yes, with one slight change. In the judiciary committee, in the judiciary letter of intent, I'm not sure if you have that letter of intent before you. Let's see, why don't you hand out this proposed change, Mark? In number three, it states dissolution would not be adverse. This is speaking of the circumstances which would have to be included for a community to dissolve. So dissolution would be not be adverse to the interests of the community served by the city, the region in which the city is located, and the state, i.e. dissolving primarily to avoid a viable tax base. Well, we feel that we should strike the words community served by the city, since that is actually what you're attempting to do through the disillusionment itself. And there are safeguards or procedures that the community has to go through in order to dissolve, including a vote by the community. So this is really, that language is really redundant. It's really for the Local Boundary Commission to review it in regards to how it affects the region and how it affects the state. So we would propose a new letter of intent which would strike the words community served by the city.
Mr. Chairman, just
senators are up.
Just a question. Can we change the language in the letter of intent from the Judiciary Committee?
Sure.
If we can do that.
Well, we can adopt a finance letter of intent.
Right. We would just adopt a finance letter of intent which would change that language. And then we'd move to adopt that on the floor.
So would, then just technical question, would both letters of intent go to the floor or would just the finance?
I'm not certain. I would assume that both letters of intent would be included in the packet and we would adopt whichever one in the body.
Yeah, I don't have any problems with
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ewing.
Yeah, the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 50, CRNA, is that the version that you want to move?
That's the version I would like to move with the adoption of the amendment from Judiciary. So we would actually have a committee substitute finance, which would adopt the Judiciary amendment. And there are a couple of technical changes on the amendment that was offered by Judiciary. They have just put the wrong section when they drafted the language of the amendment. If you have the amendment before you, it states, page 2, line 2, insert a new section 3 to read section 3. It should be a new section 4, since there is already an existing section 3
Mr. Chairman.
In the Community and Regional Affairs substitute. Senator Duncan.
Chair, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference, but this the present section 3 is 290610C. This is 290610A. What they've done is they've replaced sections. They've put this in section 3 and renumbered the other section accordingly. I think this is more proper. I think their amendment is correct. They just changed...
I see, as a subsection A.
Right. They just changed section 3 to section 4, and I think the way they did it is correct, if we want to be absolutely...
Right, right. You're correct.
It would work either way, I think, but...
Yeah. Okay, the chair would adopt the motion to... move out, if there's no further questions on this legislation, move out a Finance Committee substitute, or first to adopt the Finance Committee substitute, or an amendment, finance, as set forth in the proposed Judiciary Committee amendment, as stated by the Judiciary Committee. Is there objection? That's adopted. So we have before us now a Committee Substitute Finance, or the committee substitute for Senate Bill 50, amended finance, an act relating to dissolution of municipality, and an attached letter of intent. Finance. Do we have a motion to move the legislation and the letter of intent?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we move out committee substitute for Senate Bill number 50, Finance, and the new letter of intent, which should be indicated as a Finance letter of intent, which was just passed out.
Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Finance is adjourned. Meeting to order. It's Wednesday, April 8th. We have present Senator Hensley, Senator Ewing, Senator Duncan, Senator Zaroff, and Senator Binkley. This morning on the agenda, we have the continuation of the confirmation hearings for Commissioner of Labor Jim Sampson. If you could please join us again this morning, Mr. Sampson. I know there were several questions at our last hearing, and I see you've produced all the information that was requested, and I appreciate that. It's very well compiled and well organized. Trying to recall where we left off, I believe we were discussing prevailing wage rates, determination of the prevailing wage rate. Let's see, Senator Hensley, I believe you were had some questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I know we're dealing with kind of a sort of a technical sort of a arena that, you know, the commissioner is relatively new and may not have gotten down into some of these gory little details, and it may well not be the the forum for getting into some of the nitty-gritty of this thing, but the and I do have a piece of legislation that's being drafted that would sort of clarify some of the discussion with respect to the prevailing wage. But I think Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to pursue some of these questions concerning that issue because of the relevancy insofar as the upcoming construction season is concerned. Now, my understanding, Mr. Commissioner, is that I have gotten, your book, and I appreciate the effort that's been put into it. I think it creates to me more questions than answers. Insofar as our debate concerning the prevailing wage the other day on the floor, we did have a letter from you indicating the number of responses that were secured from the various contractors. And I guess my question to you is, how many surveys or questionnaires are generally sent out to various contractors, and what percentage of response do you get?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that 950,000 questionnaires went out in the last survey, and whatever the responses that are listed in item number two in the book that we put together are those responses. I am just assuming that the surveys that went out in 1986 may have been somewhat smaller in number than 85, 84, 83, 82, depending on economic activity in the construction industry. I would assume that there's a good chance that surveys would be less next year, depending on what type of construction season we have.
So you don't know how many actual questionnaires were sent out?
It was in the 900s. That's the information I've received.
Okay, and do you know what the percentage of the response may have been?
Mr. Chairman, I have to check on that to Senator Hensley. I would think of, I haven't added these up here, this in under tab number two, but my recollection, I guess, somebody mentioned it last week, was 400 and something, but I have the list of surveys in here on who they were sent out to, and I don't know if there's a total under tab number two, Senator, but I have every contractor that the 1986 survey was sent to and indicated whether they responded yes or no pursuant to your request made here a week or two ago.
Okay.
So
Mr. Chairman, I noticed that in the list you have one company listed 10 times. Does that mean you count his responses as John Wayne Construction now? Does that mean that you count him 10 times, or why would he be listed 10 times?
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming, Senator, you had 10 different projects going on. It's per project, not per contractor. We sent them out to the employers per project, so I'm sure that, I assume that John Wayne Construction had 10 different projects going on.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I understand. The commentary I've gotten back from people who were involved in your department maintained that there's only about a 3% response to your questionnaire, and that the questionnaire was not in the 900s, but generally in the, there were like 2,000 or 3,000 projects that they monitor. Is the response I got.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question would be who, I would have to ask who you talked with, Senator.
The person's not with your department anymore.
The person's not
with your department anymore.
Yeah, I would, I received this information from Don Wilson, Deputy Director of Labor Standards and Safety, that had the responsibility to perform that survey, and if somebody that's not with the department is saying otherwise, I guess I'd like to know who that is and what information he has to that's different than this. I received this from the gentleman that did the survey for the department.
That's fine. I have further questions on that. Now, you did state at the last meeting that you preferred to have a single wage for the state. Did you not?
Mr. Chairman, I think if my memory serves me, we were discussing different people's views as it relates to what we use today as far as the regions, whether they're realistic or unrealistic. And I think I made the comment that I felt it all depends on what one feels is to be realistic or not. I felt that they were realistic, and but I wouldn't have any problem with one survey.
You preferred a single rate for the entire state.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm satisfied now, maybe to clarify that statement, I'm satisfied with the way in which the regions are today.
Okay.
I guess I was only trying to say that, I guess I was only trying to let you know that I was satisfied with how they are today, and I guess I'll just leave it.
Okay. Just for saying that, Mr. Chairman. I understand also you stated that your normal approach is to survey primarily large public projects, industrial projects. You mentioned those, Hurricane Gulch, and I don't know, a whole series of large projects that you generally keyed into your statistics. And of course, these would normally be projects that would be state projects, would they not? State or municipal projects?
Mr. Chairman, in most cases, they would. And those comments were in the Senate Labor and Finance Committee here on Senate Resolution 24. And I was trying to make a point that when there was a discussion relating to urban versus rural rates, that in this state, there are many projects, large projects, and I did cite some of the hydroelectric projects and dams and some road projects that one has to look at the construction tradesmen, mm-hmm. and that one has to look at where they come from, where they would normally come to build a large project such as that. And the example of Hurricane Gulch was only to say that there are not skilled tradesmen in the area of Cantwell and McKinley to build Hurricane Gulch Bridge.
But the point I want to make is that a large number of these of the survey is directed at basically public construction. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chairman, it depends. I guess it depends at what's happening in the marketplace. And in this state, it's true that we've had a tremendous amount of money over the years in capital projects, and therefore, I guess that would be correct. We survey commercial work. I was trying to make the distinction between what is surveyed in AS 360510, and that is commercial heavy construction, highway construction. We don't normally do residential construction. We do have, my understanding, a cooperative agreement with Housing and Urban Development, but our surveys, as reflected on AS 360510, are commercial projects, and they are a separate defined projects.
Okay, but the point I'm trying to make is that generally those projects are paying the prevailing wage, are they not?
Yeah, that's correct. They should be, Senator.
And going, Mr. Chairman, going to this matter of the agreement between the federal government and the state, first of all, I do note that you do have more than one area. You know, you maintain that there is these two areas, the 63rd parallel, that's the sort of the dividing line for your prevailing wage determination, but you also have some separate rates for Southeast Alaska. Is that not correct? For instance, don't the plumbers have a separate rate for Southeast Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. The area, my understanding, Senator, the area south of 63rd is further divided into two regions, one in southeast and one in south central.
Now, Chairman, is there anything to prevent you from using other regions, other natural regions of the state in your prevailing wage determination under the statute?
Let me say, Mr. I think there is some flexibility on the part of Commissioner and the statute and the regulations to recognize other areas of the state.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, I believe that there is no prohibition whatsoever for you to use whatever sub-regions that you desire, is there, under the statute?
Mr. Chairman, probably not. If the Commissioner believes those to be a better indication of what the rates should be.
Mr. Chairman, in further pursuing that, my understanding is, Commissioners, that under your agreement with the federal government, they direct you to calculate the prevailing wage under CFR, 29 CFR something another, section 1.7. And this is sort of written for the lower 48, I can tell by the language, but it says here that in making the wage determination, the area, quote unquote, will normally be the county unless sufficient current wage data on wages paid on current projects or where necessary projects under construction no more than 1 year prior to the beginning of the survey or the request for a wage determination, as appropriate, is unavailable to make a wage determination. If there has not been sufficient similar construction within the area in the past year to make a wage determination, wages paid on similar construction and surrounding counties may be considered, provided that projects in metropolitan counties may not be used as a source of data for a wage determination in a rural county, and projects in rural counties may not be used as a source of data for a wage determination for a metropolitan county. So in the calculation of your prevailing wage, actually you lump the prevailing wage statistics, do you not?
Mr. Chairman, I don't understand the question.
According to your survey, you survey projects that are going on in Anchorage. You survey projects that are going on in, you know, in the urban areas, and you survey projects that are going on outside the urban community. And in your determination of the prevailing wage, you basically commingle the figures, so to speak. Do you not?
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding of how it was done and has been done since the since the surveys were started here in the state.
Is that not in violation of this the federal code?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not familiar with federal code. I didn't sign the cooperative agreement. Whether or not it's in violation of or not, I couldn't answer that. We may have, the former commissioner may have interpreted it differently. I don't know. You'd have to ask him.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that they take a look at that to see if they're in fact following the federal code insofar as their approach to calculating the prevailing wage is concerned. I seriously doubt, Mr. Chairman, whether or not if there are some penalties involved, you know, to the contractors that are not paying the prevailing wage. And I seriously doubt whether or not this approach that we're utilizing in calculating the prevailing wage would actually stand up in court.
I think, if I might, Senator Hensley, I think that the point that Senator Hensley is getting to, Commissioner, is that it really is, well, my interpretation of the statute and the corresponding regulations is that it really is your determination by our state, Little Davis-Bacon Act and the corresponding regulations, really your determination as to how you want to adjust it, on what the scope of those regions ought to be, and how and on what periodically is the best determination to have those studies. You can do them as often as you wish, and on any variation of the areas that you wish, and I think that Senator Hensley is trying to point out the federal Davis-Bacon wage rate studies actually do go in and look at rural areas as opposed to urban areas and say that there is a difference in the prevailing wage in rural areas as opposed to urban areas, and that we, over the years, have kind of lumped those together, and that causes some significant problems, particularly in the rural areas. And, you know, what are you, as a commissioner of labor, who really has the determination of how that's done, planning to do about that?
Mr. Chairman, I realize these are my continuation of my confirmation hearings. I realize this issue is important to the Senator and others, but I have to be honest with you. I don't like the methodology used by the federal government. Those were administrative changes that Reagan put in upon being elected, and I don't think they should be used. I think the way that we have done it in the past is appropriate, and I have to say that. I think it makes good long-term economic sense. I think it is in the benefit of the worker, the construction worker, whether that worker lives in rural Alaska or in urban Alaska. The act was passed for the workers and not for contracting agencies or employers. And I'm a strong believer of that, Senator. And I have to say that in this state, in rural Alaska, in many places, there's not enough work there to really accurately generate good statistical data for construction workers in this state. And I don't believe that people in rural Alaska should be treated any different than those anywhere else. I believe that if those statistics were used and that type of methodology was used, that the wages of those in rural Alaska will be severely diminished, and I don't think that's fair, and I think that the workers in rural Alaska would disagree with that. They feel they should be treated like anybody else, and that's my feeling.
What, Commissioner, do you think is the purpose of this act? Isn't it indeed to actually determine what the local prevailing wage is in those areas?
That's true.
Isn't that really the purpose of it?
That's true, Senator, is, and I think that in our state, I think that it's important to recognize the geographical differences in the state, and one has to look at, and it's a view that is shared by many others. I don't believe I'm alone in my views on the act. There's people that have a long history in Davis-Bacon, former Secretary of Labor Marshall, former Secretary of Labor John Dunlap under Ford. Many secretaries of labor in this state disagree, in this country and in states, disagree with that methodology. And I think that one has to look at what's a region that is appropriate. You know, an example is if somebody wanted me to perform a survey to really show that the prevailing wage is, let's say, an area. Just take the Kobuk area. That's a good example. Senator, there's nothing going on in the Kobuk area right now. I mean, I don't know of any projects going on in those areas. Well, And so I guess what I'm saying is that if you look at what's happening in Ambler, Buckland, Deering, Kiana, Kivalina, Norvik, Selawik, and Chung, there's really nothing going on except for a little building, I think, and no attack. And one has to look at the types of projects that we have in this state. I mean,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hensley.
This gentleman is speaking in complete violation of the Code of Federal Regulations and what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Now, it says right here that you can go back a year if you needed to in order to calculate a prevailing wage. Is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, I have had no involvement in writing or the cooperative agreement with the Federal Department of Labor.
I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that he take a look at the Code of Federal Regulations. And it says right here you're not supposed to use the metropolitan numbers in calculating your prevailing wage in the rural counties. Does it not say that?
Mr. Chairman, the way I understand it is that that the federal U.S. Department of Labor has certain regulations and procedures they use in surveying wages on federal contracts. My understanding further that the Memorandum of Understanding really says that they will use our data or won't use our data. They can do with it what they want to do with it. I think that the agreement that we reached with the U.S. Department of Labor relates to wages that they would use on their projects, not on state projects. I'm not saying that we are or we're not in violation of the Uniform Code. I can only say, Senator, that if we are, it was done without me being here. I mean, I wasn't involved in the survey last year. I just, in answer to the chairman, I felt this committee should know how I feel on this issue. It's a very important issue to me. If there's been a violation by the Department of Labor, it was done last year and not since I've been here.
Continue.
I think that's important to...
I think it is too, Commissioner, and I think that's really the purpose of the hearings is to get a feel for what your philosophy is on many of these issues and how that relates to the implementation of these regulations, because it affects us very much. I mean, it affects us tremendously. And if your feeling is, as you stated at the last meeting, that if it were up to you, which it is up to you, you would have one prevailing wage rate for the whole state, that causes me some problems.
Senator.
And that's different from my philosophy, which is that the local prevailing wage rate is really to determine in fairly specific areas what the real wage rate is in those areas. And to continue on that, you mentioned that you felt that many of the rural communities would really want the Davis-Bacon wage rates in those communities. Are you familiar with force accounting?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
And that's where municipalities or local communities actually take over the project and hire the people to do the job.
Yes.
And you know the reason that so many communities do that? Is because we can't afford to pay the Davis-Bacon wages, and that's not the local prevailing wage, and that's a way around the regulations that are the prevailing wage rate that's been set up. And that's, people don't want the Davis-Bacon wage rates in the villages.
Mr. Chairman.
Because it's not the local prevailing wage.
I guess my response to that would be, Senator, and again, I think it's important for me to say I'm satisfied with the three regions of the state as they are today, okay? And I think that's fair. Secondly, I don't disagree that the use of force count, which has been used more widely here in the last few years, I don't disagree with you at all when you say that the purpose is to lower the wages for the workers. So the other argument there is that it allows more flexibility when those employees are on the payroll of that municipality to hire local people, and I think that has been successful. But I guess I was trying to make the differentiation between municipal governments and workers. I don't know any workers that think they're paid too much, and I guess the only thing I was trying to say, Senator, is that the construction workers themselves, it's my belief, don't like the use of force account work to cut the wages in half and to make those
that may be the case for the union workers that come off the benches to come out to the villages to go to work, but it's not the case for the local people who have an opportunity to then go to work if the wages are something that's really the local prevailing wage rate. And that's my concern. Senator Hensley?
Yeah, I'd like to sort of clarify what I believe is a total misperception on the part of the commissioner. He sees this as an attack, on the working people. And in reality, what's driving us is the fact that we are concerned about getting people to work out there in those rural areas, where they may not be able to compete, with a contractor and somebody off the bench in Anchorage, who is going to be getting paid $25 or $30 an hour, on a prevailing wage job, And we have these projects in our back doors, and if the prevailing wage is so out of whack with the actual prevailing wage in the area,
And the contract is going to get, you know, a 10 or 12 year, you know, experienced this or that, and maybe not take a chance on somebody who has half that amount of experience, you know. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to get some little iota of concern on your part that these prevailing wages are indeed the prevailing wage of those areas, and not the prevailing wage at Poodle Bay or in Anchorage. Now, is there something wrong with that?
Mr. Chairman, no, they're not. I guess that my view is that the problem of rural residents being displaced by those that don't live there is not a problem that originated here in the last few days or the last year. It's been a real problem for a long time in the state, and I'm as sensitive to that as anybody. I'm probably the biggest supporter of Alaska Hire and those that live in certain areas of this state getting preference in work. I don't know of anybody that has stronger feelings on that than I do. I am a strong advocate that those that live in an area have a chance to go to work before Alaskans that don't live in that area. I'm also an advocate of once those local people that are qualified have an opportunity to work in their backyard, then those jobs should go to other Alaskans instead of those that live outside here. And I made the commitment to work hard to ensure that that local people in those areas get jobs, and I'll make it again to you, Senator, in this committee. I guess my only difference is that I have to be honest and say that I have to disagree that the cause of rural people not getting jobs is due to the Little Davis-Bacon Act. That's not the reason, in my view.
Senator, would you mind stating what you believe the reasons are?
Well, I think the as far as the construction industry is concerned, and that's if that's really the area we're focusing on, since we're talking about AS-36, is I believe that the biggest problem of rural people not having construction work is two or threefold. One, it's a very competitive market out there, and contractors move. You're seeing more contractors move in this state than has ever moved before. Usually contractors used to work and bid jobs right in their own little area. Now, because of the competition in the marketplace, they're moving in different parts of the state, and they're bringing crews with them. And they bid work based on what they feel their workforce can do, and they come in and they take the work. And that's union and non-union contractors, whether they have agreements or not. One of the second reasons is that unions have not allowed or recognized the need of rural Alaskans to work. And some unions have. Some unions have been real good at that. I come from a background where we did promote local hire in those areas, and we did take a lot of the people in and allow them to work. There are some of the trades that maybe don't do that. Secondly, I think that people in rural Alaska have to be trained in a competitive market. They have to somehow sell their workforce. And when you're talking about large projects in the construction industry, they have to be competitive in the marketplace. And they need to spend more time training to be qualified to take those jobs. I think there's a real concern on the part of employers not to hire those that are unknown to them. And I think if employers gave many of them just a half a chance, they would be satisfied with the workforce.
Sure.
Senator.
Well, what are you willing to do in order to help ensure that people living in the environs of these public works projects, so to speak, have an opportunity to work?
Mr. Chair, I'm willing to look at those employers that are Alaskan employers or other employers that come up here and compete in the industry of bringing their crews in to use whatever means that I have available to me to convince them it's in their best interest to hire local people. Conversely, those unions in this state that are not sensitive to the concerns of the rural residents and construction projects, I'll use whatever means that are at my disposal to convince them that it's in their best interest to start working and trying to get those people jobs. Those, whether they have bargaining agreements in the construction industry or don't, I'm committed to doing whatever I can to expedite the process of data collection, occupational data collection, to trigger employment preferences if certain areas of the state are meet the criteria to do so. I think that my department has a number of tools available to it, to maybe persuasion tools that one can use to convince contractors that it's in their best interest to hire local people. I also am a strong advocate that contractors, I guess I would encourage those entities in rural Alaska that have a workforce to know their workforce, know the skills that the workforce can have, and I would use my department to assist any of those entities to meet with both labor or management long before projects or public projects are sent to bid, to let contractors know what is available. I think that's a real problem. Contractors don't know what's available in these regions, or they don't really care, I guess, and they just need to have that information available to them to bid. It's cheaper for the employer in rural Alaska to hire local residents. I don't know why they don't.
Well, one of the reasons is the wages. Well, when you have to pay $30 an hour for a carpenter, it's difficult to convince a contractor to hire local people to pay those $30 an hour. He gets his, just like you said, he gets the same crew that he's worked all over the state with and brings them in. If it was really the local prevailing wage, which may be $15 an hour for a carpenter, the contractor would be happy to hire local people.
Well,
people that maybe weren't, as you stated, weren't as competitive, weren't as well trained, so that they could get some of that experience.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I guess it depends on what types of jobs we're talking about. You know, I don't know if that's the view of the contractors. I've dealt with the contractor employees in this state for the last 10 or 12 years, and that's sure not the impression they give me. They, you know, whether the Davis-Bacon rate was $20 an hour or $15 an hour, they bid a project based on productivity and profits and transportation costs and prices and wage costs, and they have schedules to meet, and they're going to hire the best people they can hire.
Well, let me ask you this, Commissioner. You've been in labor for a long, long time. If, for instance, there was a job to build a high school in Tuntutuliak, and the wages for a carpenter on that job were $12 an hour, do you think that carpenters from Fairbanks would want to work in Tuntutuliak, would want to travel out to Tuntutuliak and spend the summer there working on a construction project for $12 an hour?
Mr. Chairman, it depends on what the economic condition of the marketplace is. If you're asking me if there's work in those areas, no one wants to travel. I mean, everybody wants to work in where they live, no matter where they live in this state. If it depends on how much work there is. And
that's right. And if the local prevailing wage in Fairbanks is $30 an hour, and they have an opportunity to work on a job there, it's going to be pretty difficult to get anybody to go out to one of the villages to work for what may be the local prevailing wages in that village.
Yeah.
Yet there are certainly people from that region, from nearby villages, that would be happy to work for those local prevailing wages.
That might be, Senator. There may, but I don't necessarily think that argument holds true. It depends on how much work there is and where the work's at in the state. And with capital projects down, you're going to see people move here in the next couple of years. They're moving already. We're seeing people working for whatever they can work for just to put food on the table. And that may be a concern as far as, in the next couple of years, those people trying to move into those areas. But I think a lot of it depends on the productivity and the competitiveness of those that work there. And we're talking about public construction work, and there's start dates and there's end dates, and they have schedules to meet, and there's certain, it's my view, and I believe it's the view of the employers, that they're going to hire the most productive, competitive people that they can, that's available in the marketplace to do the work, whether that's in the village or whether that's in the urban areas of the state.
Senator Hinsman.
I appreciate your comments about what do you think that you